Hi everyone, thank you for coming. Today we're very fortunate enough to have Abby Kreutz. Abby received her BS from Caltech, where she was a SURF three times, if I'm saying anything wrong, correct me. And she spent 4 years doing research studying the CMB with Andrew Lange. After that, she went on to do her doctorate at UChicago, where she worked on the South Pole Telescope, and she went to Antarctica three times. Since then, she's been a Keck Institute for Space Studies postdoctoral fellow here. She works in the Observational Cosmology Group, doing millimeter wavelength instrumentation to study the early universe. And with that, take it away, Abby.
Oh, thank you. Can everyone hear me okay in the back? Yeah, I don't know if I can top that Jaguar. but yeah, so thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. And I'm going to be talking to you about measuring the cosmic microwave background with the South Pole Telescope and kind of the future of the CMB field and kind of trying to tie it into some of the gravitational wave investigations that people in the LIGO group and others are doing. So hopefully I make some connections to people here today to CMB, and you're welcome to talk to me later if you have any other questions. So I'm just going to put one objective up here that the cosmic microwave background folks are trying to study, which is to detect signatures from inflationary gravitational waves in the cosmic microwave background. So we're doing this because we want to probe physics of the universe basically fractions of a second after the Big Bang and try to get at physics that we can't really study in any other way. And to kind of tie this into gravitational wave experiments, I took this slide from Planck, but this is basically showing the gravitational wave spectrum and what kinds of instruments you can use to probe it. So you can see up here that there's a lot of different sources of gravitational waves, including quantum fluctuations in the early universe. And these have a very large range of scales, and at these large scales, you know, we can probe that potentially with the cosmic microwave background. And then, you know, as this field matures, we can kind of see what possibilities there are for probing it across the full spectrum. So this is the cosmic microwave background. This is the cosmic microwave background as it's measured by Planck. I'm sure you've all seen this before. And I'm going to kind of come at this from an instrumental point of view and talk to you about how you make a measurement of the cosmic microwave background, what kinds of different parameters do our instruments have, and you know, why is it challenging and what do we do. So observing the early universe, I have a few things that make it challenging. So one of the things is that the signals that we're trying to measure are very small. I think that probably LIGO folks are familiar with small signals. And also the wavelengths of the light that we're trying to measure are very different from the light that we measure with our eyes and with everyday cameras. So this makes it difficult. If you look at the cosmic microwave background, you know, you can see these beautiful fluctuations, but they're like very amplified in the pictures that you see. So we need high sensitivity instruments to actually measure them. So what actually makes it worthwhile? Why are we going after this measurement? So as I mentioned sort of before, we can probe physics in the very early universe, kind of when the universe was less complicated by the astrophysics that we have today. And we can also probe high energy physics that's hard to create or impossible to create in the modern universe, even with really big particle accelerators. So this is a picture of the South Pole Telescope, and then this is a very incomplete list of all of the instruments that are trying to measure the cosmic microwave background for kind of past, present, and shortly into the future, though focusing really on like the last decade. So if you don't see your favorite instrument up there, here, that's okay. It's still important. I'm going to be focusing on SBT Pole, the instrument that I worked on for my PhD. If you're interested in CMB in general, there's folks in the audience and on the third floor that are working on this series of BICEP experiments to probe gravitational waves. And then there's other collaborations around the US and the world also trying to probe the cosmic microwave background. So what do you need for a successful CMB instrument? So one of the things you need is an observing site. You need sensitivity, so that you can measure those faint signals, and you need resolution because the resolution of your telescope kind of determines what scales on the sky you measure and what physics you can probe. So to talk about the atmosphere, this is a spectrum of the transmission of the atmosphere as a function of frequency, And if you zoom in, this actually zooms in on some of our typical bands for measuring the cosmic microwave background. And what you can see is that the atmosphere is actually pretty transmissive in the CMB frequencies, which is excellent. That means we can do measurements from the ground. But the amplitude of this is actually very much dependent on water vapor. So we want to go to a site that's very dry. You know, so we would go to space or to balloons, or if you're making a measurement from the ground, to a very dry site such as the South Pole or the Atacama Desert. And you know, this is what the South Pole looks like. The reason it's so dry is that it's actually 10,000 feet above sea level and the atmosphere is extremely cold, so you don't actually get a lot of precipitation. You just get the water vapor actually frozen out of the air. So it looks really flat, but it's actually like a very big plateau, very high above sea level. So what's the next thing that you need? So I mentioned that you need a very high sensitivity instrument. So you need a lot of detectors that work with very low noise at the frequencies that you care about measuring. And one of the key technologies for this is the superconducting transition edge sensor bolometer. And this is kind of the main technology used for CMB, though there are a couple of other, like both past and future technologies for actually making measurements of the cosmic microwave background. But this is the most common. And the way this sensor works is that if you have photons from the cosmic microwave background or something else, it actually hits an absorber. That absorber heats up from those photons. And if you have a very sensitive thermometer, you can actually read out the change in power on your detector from those tiny photons hitting there. And this is what a bolometer looks like in real life. This is actually one from another instrument I work on, not SPT pole, but it kind of shows you what a bolometer looks like. And this is the absorber, so it's a mesh that's has gold deposited on it that couples to the photons from the sky. Over here, there's a tiny little sensor, and then these are the leads that read out the detector. And as you can see, these are kind of on the scale of millimeter size. The way the sensors actually work is that they kind of work like a resistor. So you have this sensor that when it's above its superconducting temperature, so this, So this is a this is temperature in Kelvin on the x-axis, and this is resistance. This is just a schematic view of a transition edge sensor. So above its transition temperature, it actually just acts like a normal resistor. And if you put a constant voltage across that sensor, it just, you know, follows Ohm's law. But as you cool down that detector and you get to its superconducting transition temperature, its resistance actually drops very, very steeply with temperature, and eventually the detector has essentially zero resistance. So kind of one of the reasons we use this is you can see that if you have a tiny change in temperature, you actually get a large change in resistance. And so when you get these photons absorbed onto your sensor, you get a very sensitive measurement of the cosmic microwave background. In reality, the way we actually use them is we actually operate them in something we call electrothermal feedback, which is basically that when you have this voltage bias across it, so there's some current going through your sensor creating some power and heating up the detector and holding it in its superconducting transition. When the temperature goes up because a photon, or a bunch of photons really, hit the sensor, it actually increases the resistance. Because we have Ohm's law and we have this at a constant voltage, the current goes down, which makes the sensor actually cool back down, and you stay in this transition at the sensor. And you can just track the current that you're measuring out from your instrument and see what the sky is doing and kind of what signals you're measuring from the sky. And this is just the schematic of what TES resistance versus temperature curve looks like. These are from a paper by one of my collaborators, Elizabeth George, showing you a couple of real temperature versus resistance curves for transition edge sensors. So you can see that they all have this normal part up here where they're a normal resistor, and then they go steeply into their superconducting transition. So I mentioned that we need lots of detectors, but what does lots of detectors mean for a current cosmic microwave background instrument? We've kind of, as a field, divided into like multiple stages. I don't know where stage one is, but you know, stage two instruments are one that SPT pole is. Current fielded instruments are like stage three, and then in the future, we're kind of going to a stage four with many, many detectors. And this is kind of the number of transition edge sensors that you need to kind of progress through this field. So, you know, these are kind of past instruments with data in the can. These are currently, or, you know, currently being fielded instruments, and these are, you know, 5 to so years down the line.
Are they all on one detector?
No. Yeah. So especially for like this stage, it's going to be many multiple telescopes. And often, even some of the current, like the Bicep Keck array telescopes, it's many different tubes with a set of detectors. So they're separate telescopes. Yeah. So one of the things about the field is that you basically just need to put more sensors on the sky to measure the cosmic microwave background to get better noise performance and more sensitive measurements of the CMB. And the reason for that is that we're basically limited by the atmosphere. So we can't make any more sensitive detectors because we're actually limited by the noise of the atmosphere. So this is what the SVT pole focal plane looks like. I say a lot of detectors. If you're thinking like optical cameras, you're thinking millions of pixels. But because our sensors are looking at a much longer wavelength of light, this is what a full camera looks like for SVT pole. And then, as I mentioned before, sorry, this is kind of a blurry image, but this is that same temperature versus resistance curve that I showed before, and this is where it's a superconductor down here. You know, if you notice, this is 0.4 Kelvin, so the detectors themselves only operated about half to a quarter of a degree above absolute zero, and a lot of the technology that goes into building these instruments actually revolves around the cryogenics to kind of get these sensors cooled and working at low temperatures and get all of the wiring to this camera at very low temperatures. And this is actually, so one of the technologies that we use cryogenically is a helium-3 sorption refrigerator. So this is basically using the rare isotope of helium, condensing it, and then pumping on it in a closed cycle refrigerator to actually get this base temperature that we need. In the past, people used liquid cryogens to cool these instruments, but we actually have mechanical pulse tube refrigerators to get everything to a base temperature of about 4 Kelvin prior to using the helium-3 fridges. So this is me at the South Pole. So as I mentioned, this is basically a bunch of essentially resistors wired up to a readout system. And I'm soldering the back of this because one of the challenges of cryogenics is like sometimes you cool down your instrument and there's electrical problems with the circuits. So this is like me fixing some electrical problems at the South Pole for SPT. And then this is just the front of that completed camera there. This is the back of the cryostat that the SVT pole focal plane goes into. This is me and the receiver team putting that focal plane in. Then we mount it on another cryostat with a secondary mirror and put it in the telescope. So this is the South Pole telescope. This is a 10-meter dish. And the receiver and detectors are all in this cabin there. So this picture kind of takes me on to what the next thing you need for a successful CMB instrument is. And that is you need to kind of decide what resolution you want, so what scale objects on the sky you want. Do you want to focus on larger scales or smaller scales? And this kind of depends on the science that you're going after. So as you know, if you have a larger dish, you can see finer scale structure on the sky. This is just comparing two. There's even smaller instruments that really focus on the large scales on the sky. But this is the 10-meter primary dish of SBT. This is the Planck satellite, so this is a 1.5-meter primary mirror. And if you look at the data from each of these instruments, you can kind of tell the difference between the resolution just by looking at the maps. And so these instruments are kind of complementary in some sense in that Planck is a satellite, has lower resolution and sensitivity. It's measuring the full sky. And then SBT pole is measuring a smaller patch on the sky at higher resolution and higher sensitivity. So this is the Planck data, and then this is what SPT pole data looks like. So what you can kind of see already is that you're seeing finer scale structure on the sky, so you're really able to measure higher resolution objects and get a kind of different science. And also you kind of see this patchy structure, which is the cosmic microwave background, in greater detail. And then you can see in SPT, you start to see like galaxies that are actually in between us and the cosmic microwave background, as well as galaxy clusters. So that's kind of one of the differences in resolution. So now I'm going to kind of talk about the science objectives of measuring the cosmic microwave background. So this is objective zero. So this is to constrain cosmological parameters that describe our universe. And we call our concordance cosmology lambda CDM cosmology, kind of in more descriptive terms. Will the universe expand forever? Is the universe dominated by dark matter? What's the shape of the universe? When did galaxies first form, and is the expansion of the universe accelerating rather than decelerating? So these are kind of things that we can constrain with the cosmic microwave background. And if you put that in terms of sort of parameters, I guess, it's you know, what's the density of atoms, like baryonic matter that we can see, versus dark matter versus dark energy. And then we have other parameters like the expansion rate of the universe, the reionization redshift, and like the tilt of the cosmic microwave background spectrum. I'll get into that. But basically, with measurements of the cosmic microwave background, we can constrain the cosmology of our universe. And WMAP actually has kind of a cool thing that you can play with online. It's pretty fun. I encourage you if you are interested. Basically, it takes simulations of the cosmic microwave background and lets you adjust the parameters like you would if you were actually analyzing cosmic microwave background data to kind of see if you can get a correct fit to this power spectrum. And, you know, if you look at this, you might not be able to see it from far away, but here, this shows you, this blue line is the power spectrum of the CMB, and this is the correct power spectrum. And this is, you know, atoms, cold dark matter, and dark energy, and it lets you adjust all of those. So you can see that if you make the universe, like, over half baryonic matter, like, that does not work very well. So I kind of played with it a little bit to try to get closer. I still don't have any dark energy in there, so I'm like, not so close. And then I was like, I got it pretty close. I picked these correctly, but I'm still not right. So I was like, tell me the answer. And then it tells you the answer, and it's like, but you also have to adjust like the other parameters of the universe. But basically, you know, it gives you a way to kind of intuitively see how we can use the cosmic microwave background to constrain cosmology. And one kind of cool connection to LIGO is that you, with the cosmic microwave background, you're able to measure the Hubble constant. And with the latest LIGO measurements, they're actually able to constrain the Hubble constant as well. And this is a plot from this paper from the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, Virgo et al. many people working on this detection that came with an EM counterpart, and you can see that you know, they have this blue line is actually the constraints that collaboration put on the Hubble constant. And while those are quite large, one of the interesting things that you can see is that this blue line, or the blue shaded region, actually tells you the constraint from Planck, and this red patch shows you the constraint from actual distance measurements from nearby structure in the universe. And you can see that they're discrepant, and this is one of the big things in the field of cosmology is, like, why are these discrepant? And, you know, as we get more and more measurements of gravitational waves from LIGO and future LIGO experiments, you could start to shrink the error bars on this and maybe start to kind of figure out whether it agrees with this, or, you know, basically figure out what the tensions are with that cosmology. So that's kind of a cool overlap. So now I've kind of talked about, you know, concordance cosmology and how we probe that with the CMB. So now I'll go on to the next science objective that I mentioned at the very beginning, which is detecting signatures from inflationary gravity waves in the early universe. So we want to probe the physics of the universe fractions of a second after the Big Bang. And the reason for this is that when we look at measurements of the cosmic microwave background, we see that the universe is very flat, it's very homogeneous. If you look in different directions, the cosmic microwave background looks the same. And you might wonder why this is true if the universe wasn't in, you know, causal contact at some earlier time. So scientists have actually postulated this theory of inflation, which is that the universe expands at an incredibly rapid rate, you know, 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the Big Bang. And this could actually imprint some signal in the cosmic microwave background because of these gravitational waves in the early universe. And, you know, so this is just an old slide from Andre Lin, just showing you basically the, you know, time after the Big Bang versus the size of the universe, and just kind of showing you that this inflation is this, like, exponential expansion that makes the universe very flat and very large. So if that's true, there might be some signature that we're actually able to measure in the cosmic microwave background, and that's kind of something that we're really trying to do. And then another science objective is that actually to measure gravitational lensing of the cosmic microwave background by the matter in our universe. So when light travels towards you, if there's a massive object in between you and the light that you're trying to measure, it actually distorts that object and acts as a lens. And that happens with, you know, galaxies can be lensed by galaxies in between us. Galaxies can be lensed by galaxy clusters. The cosmic microwave background can also be lensed by intervening matter in the universe. And one of the cool things is that the properties of neutrinos actually affect the structure in our universe, and they will affect how much that light from the CMB is actually lensed by the intervening matter in the universe. And neutrinos are very difficult to measure typically because they don't actually interact very much. So it's kind of nice that we actually can get a probe of neutrinos from a measurement of the cosmic microwave background. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about how exactly we make that measurement. So we make maps of the CMB, and then we need to get statistical information out of them, which is how we actually make measurements of the cosmological parameters. So I'll show like a little tutorial just to kind of give you a sense of how you actually go from those maps to power spectra. And this is from a colleague of mine in OBSCoS, Phil. So he made these tutorials that kind of help you understand. So on the left here is like the map of the CMB, and here is the power spectrum. So you can see this is like just like a wave, and it has a spike at a given frequency. And then as you make that wave smaller, the peak in the spectrum goes out to higher and higher frequencies. And this is also something, so when you're looking at these plots of the CMB power spectra, like the small scales are over here on the right and the large scales are on the left. So then if you look at a map that looks like this, so as bumps and wiggles at pretty large scales, you can see you get a bump at large scales. You know, if you have very small fluctuations, you get a bump at small scales. And then say you have the, you know, funny CMB that has both, so you see power on all the scales that you have in your map. So of course we've done that. So if you take the Planck W map, this is just ACT and SBT, so this is a subset of the CMB data. And then you take maps of those, then you take the power spectrum, you get this power spectrum that we saw from those WMAP tutorials allow you to predict the parameters of our universe. But one thing that I have not mentioned yet is, so, okay, what do you need for a successful CMB instrument? I mentioned like a good atmospheric site, lots of detectors, and a telescope with a resolution that lets you measure the scales you care about. Currently, we actually are working in the regime where we also want the ability to detect the polarization of the CMB. So that's going to let us go beyond that, just measuring those parameters in the lambda CDM cosmology model, and allow us to get at other physics that we care about. And so we know that the CMB is polarized, and that's because during the early universe, there were photons and electrons and, you know, atoms, and everything was scattering off of each other in this really hot, dense state. And also things were anisotropic, so there were hot spots and cold spots in that early universe. And when those photons scatter off of electrons in this anisotropic early universe, you actually induce a linear polarization. So you get basically a stronger signal in one polarization than the other. So we know that the cosmic microwave background is polarized, and we should expect that when we make a measurement of the cosmic microwave background. And this is a simulation of the temperature of the cosmic microwave background with little vectors on there to show you the polarization. And one thing we can do is we can actually decompose this into what we call E modes and B modes. This is just even parity and odd parity modes, so symmetric and not symmetric modes. And what we know is that from that Thomson scattering, you only expect to get symmetric modes. So if you see anything else in the cosmic microwave background, that tells you that you're seeing some other physics phenomenon. And that's kind of what we're capitalizing on to make these measurements. So these are the power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. So these are just simulations. So this is the temperature power spectrum that we've measured very well with a lot of different experiments. This is what that symmetric EE polarization power spectrum looks like. And you expect to get that from the acoustic oscillations in the early universe. But you also get other physics. And that's kind of what we're really focusing on with future experiments. So this is what the BB inflationary gravitational wave spectrum will look like if it has a certain amplitude of inflationary gravitational waves in the early universe. And so one of the instruments on campus, BICEP2, and some of the folks upstairs have put like the best constraint on this power spectrum of basically a limit of R of 0.12. And this is from analyzing BICEP data at the South Pole with Planck data. And the way they do that is that if you know that your instrument is sensitive enough to measure a BB inflationary gravitational wave signal, if it were to be here, and you don't see that signal, then you basically rule out certain amplitudes of the inflationary gravitational wave spectra. So this is kind of another tie-in to LIGO, that LIGO actually wrote a paper about upper limits on the stochastic gravitational wave background from advanced LIGO. And they made this pretty cool plot, which shows you the frequency of the inflationary gravitational waves. And then they kind of put where the LIGO and LISO future points will be. And then they also put a measurement of the cosmic microwave background. And this is just for one model of inflation. So one of the complications to this is that there's many models of inflation, and they can predict different and even completely unmeasurable amplitudes of the inflationary gravitational waves during the early universe. So we're really ruling out models, or potentially, if we have a favorable universe for our experiments, actually being able to measure it. But this just shows you that one of the nice things is that this increases in the first fractions of a or at really low frequencies. So we're measuring inflationary gravitational waves, and like that actual background is like a great thing to do with the cosmic microwave background. It's a little harder to do here, but yeah, I don't know. You never know. So going back to basically the power spectra, so depending on the theory of inflation, it can predict different amplitudes of this BB inflationary wave power spectra. And we make more and more sensitive instruments, because the more sensitive your instrument is, the more of these models you can actually rule out by not detecting or detecting a signal. So then the other thing that I mentioned is that you can actually get a signal from gravitational lensing of the cosmic microwave background by intervening matter in the universe. So if you have the cosmic microwave background as your backlight and it's traveling towards you, it actually gets distorted by matter in the universe. And one way you can kind of think about it, I guess intuitively, is that if you have a very symmetric pattern and that gets then distorted by intervening matter, it can add a odd parity mode and be distorted rather than symmetric. And so then you can see that showing up in the lensing of this symmetric EE power spectrum to the BB power spectrum. So the interesting thing about the amplitude of the spectrum is that this is actually affected by how much mass neutrinos have. So we know that neutrinos have some mass from neutrino oscillation experiments. And we have an upper limit, a very high upper limit, on the mass, some of the masses of the neutrinos that's like in the EV range, like 7 EV. But if neutrinos have some mass and they're relativistic in the early universe, they actually act kind of like hot dark matter. And so instead of falling into the potential wells, they actually stream out at those early times. So they actually suppress some power in our universe. And actually, you get overall, if you kind of look at the integration of that kind of matter power spectrum, which is kind of what this measurement of the EE to BB lensing is, you actually see a change in amplitude based on the sum of the masses of the neutrinos. So that actually has an effect on the BB power spectrum. So that's one way we can probe neutrinos with the cosmic microwave background that we wouldn't be able to probe using other methods. So we have to make a really excellent measurement of this to kind of separate those. As you can see, this is 1.5 EV, so you need a really sensitive measurement of this power spectrum to put constraints on some of the masses of the neutrinos. And this kind of shows you this a little bit in, so this is actually the matter power spectrum with zero neutrino mass is like this line. So if you subtract the matter power spectrum with some massive neutrinos, you can see that the more massive the neutrino, the more it suppresses the matter power spectrum on some small scales. And then that integral is what gets you the amplitude of the BB power spectrum. So this is like the matter power spectrum if you have zero neutrino mass minus the matter power spectrum if you have X neutrino mass, divided by the matter power spectrum, so a flat line is like zero. Yeah.
Okay, so percent change.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now I've kind of talked to you about our instruments and the science that we want to do with these instruments, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we make a CMB measurement in practice. So we have this map of the cosmic microwave background, or whatever map you have from your CMB instrument. And you have to do this very large procedure to actually get those maps. So this is kind of just to, so that, I don't know, I think it's fun for folks from other kind of areas of science to get an idea for how we actually make these in practice. So it's a little bit technical into like the weeds, but it's something you can ask me about later if you're interested. But basically, what we start with is raw data. So this is actually just measurements from our detectors as you scan across the sky. This is just read out on the screen, like straight at the South Pole. But when you're actually making the measurement, you take many, many time streams of your telescope as it scans across the sky, and then you have to make those into maps. So you read in raw data, there's many artifacts in that data that you either interpolate over, or yeah, do you have a question?
What's the periodic signal?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So this is actually what we called like our first light measurement with SPT pole, and we're actually scanning across a H2 region on the sky. So this is actually a point source. We're actually scanning across a point source, so the blip is us scanning across a bright millimeter wave source. So we wouldn't actually scan across this if we were making a CMB observation. This is just to show that our detector is alive. And we do use that for calibration on like a daily basis as well. But yeah, good catch. And this one's like off or broken or something. So it's like, it's real. It's real life. Yeah.
So is
like
a long time scale structure, is that detector systematics, or is that actual structure?
That's atmosphere. Yeah. So like we subtract that. We basically do like a polynomial subtraction across each scan to remove atmosphere. We interpolate over glitches and kind of remove some data if it's actually bad. You know, we do a calibration. You don't need to follow all this. but you can look at it later if you're interested. We remove time streams that are noisy for whatever reason or that are off based on like accounting that we do in our instrument. And then we make maps of the instrument. So it's scanning back and forth across the sky, so we make maps. And then we add those into bundles, and we actually have maps of the CMB. And that's what these are here. So, you know, Planck's made this big measurement of the sky. We're measuring this small patch of sky, scanning back and forth many, many times, making many maps. And then we cross-correlate pairs of maps after we mask out those point sources. So there's bright point sources in every field that we mask out before we actually take the power spectrum. So after you have your maps, you make a power spectrum. So it's basically a cross-correlation between many, many maps. There's some complication to that in that if you're actually trying to make that measurement correctly, you have to remove the beam of your instrument. You also have a transfer function because I mentioned you subtract out that stuff. You subtract out the atmosphere by removing a polynomial. So you have to actually do simulations of your observations and figure out how your actual maps are being affected by the transfer function and reverse that by doing that on simulations. And then you also have to do something called mode mixing, which is accounting for the fact that you're actually, you know, cutting pieces out of your map and then taking a Fourier transform of that. So this is what power spectra look like after you make that measurement. So as you can see, they're pretty noisy. So this is that EE power spectrum. This is the one that comes from acoustic oscillations in the early universe. So this is a few instruments. So this is from a few years ago. This was our first measurement of the EE power spectrum from SPT pole, and then we put it on with other measurements from other current instruments in the field. And then this is that BB lensing power spectrum. So this is including data from four experiments, SPT pole, ACT, Bicep Keck, and Polar Bear. And the gray lines that you see under there are actually not fits to the data, but they are the concordance cosmology model. So you can kind of see that our data is fitting that model pretty well, or you know that data is consistent with that model, and that we're actually like measuring a detection of this signal. As you can see, like you're probably not going to be constraining neutrino mass on like the 1 MeV level with data like this. So kind of the future of our field is making better and better measurements of this so that we can actually put cosmological constraints on things.
And the gray line in this one, is that from the neutrino masses? Is that how you get to?
So this is with zero neutrino mass, probably. but this is just like what, like the change that you would see from different neutrino masses is small here. It might not be zero, but it's like you wouldn't see that in this, I think. Yeah, that would be too small. So this is measurements from our actual first year of SPT pole data. And this is kind of what that field looks like on the sky. So this red outline shows you where those maps came from on the sky. We actually have now in the can, like 3 more years of data on a slightly bigger field in the sky. And this is a field that's accessible from the South Pole, so it's actually also measured with the BICEP-Keck experiments. You know, this is kind of the accessible region of the sky from the South Pole. And, you know, this is what the maps from that full field look like. These were published last summer in Henning et al. And then they also measured the EE power spectrum from this map. They haven't yet published the BB power spectrum, so this is kind of the different papers that we've written from this SP2 pole data. So these are the early papers that we wrote, and then there have been a couple of other papers since that first year data, and then a measurement of that lensing B mode power spectrum from this full 500 square degrees is currently in prep. So what's next for the cosmic microwave background? So you know, as you can see from like that data, you know, we really need to make more and more sensitive measurements of this power spectrum and, you know, get higher sensitivity so we can hope to roll out more models for this inflationary gravitational wave spectrum. One thing that I didn't mention that might be on your minds if you've been kind of following the cosmic microwave background field is that I haven't mentioned really foregrounds at all. So one of the biggest challenges of making this measurement is that there are signals from our galaxy that can mimic the signals that we're trying to measure from the cosmic microwave background. And the way that we try to avoid that is we actually look at many different frequencies instead of just probing the cosmic microwave background at a single or two or three frequencies. The direction the field is going is to actually probe the cosmic microwave background in, you know, about 7 bands across the spectrum, where the synchrotron radiation from our galaxy and dust kind of cross and are minimized, like, but also, you know, probing those signals with high and low frequency channels to actually hope to do component separation and actually remove the foregrounds from the CMB measurements. And this is a kind of old plot, and it was made by the class experiment, so you can kind of see there's this sort of taking over, but this shows you the angular scale in the sky versus the frequency coverage of the different instruments. And this kind of gives you an idea about what I was talking about earlier. You can kind of pick your resolution of your instrument to, you know, maximize what you're interested in studying. So it's kind of, let's see, like you can see that this is one of the first BICEP experiments, so this is kind of an old plot. But what the experiments are really doing is kind of like going towards getting as much frequency coverage as possible over sort of the angular scales where the signal from inflationary gravitational waves would actually peak. And one of the things that is next for CMB, so all of the experiments in the field are really going towards making multi-frequency instruments with as high sensitivity as possible. But there's also a project called CMB Stage 4, and this is the logo because it's kind of showing like instruments at both the South Pole and in Chile. Basically, the field sort of coming together to do a large project where you can have many different sites and many different instruments like you were talking about. We're not going to get all of the sensitivity in one telescope. But have many different telescopes at sites across the U.S., across the world, trying to get the sensitivity that we need to actually make these measurements. And if you want, like, the technical parameters for how you can improve parameters, this is a plot from the CMB S4 technology book, and it shows you as a function of year here on the y-axis, you know, what you'll expect for different parameters. So the one that's maybe easiest to comprehend is like this is the sum of the neutrino masses. So stage two experiments are around 0.15 eV. If we go all the way to, you know, 2023 and CMB stage four experiments, we would like to improve that by an order of magnitude. So you're actually possibly getting a detection of neutrino mass by bringing that upper limit really close to the current lower limit that we have on that parameter. And then this isn't the only science that you can do with this. Of course, this parameterizes the inflation during the early universe. And you can also actually study dark energy if you can measure many clusters using the SZ effect in the cosmic microwave background. You can actually start to probe dark energy as well. So I can talk about that more in the future. I'll basically wrap up by saying that, you know, what do we need to measure the cosmic microwave background? I kind of hope I've shared that with you. We need polarization sensitivity. We need many detectors at many frequencies to remove foregrounds. And these are the science goals that we can hope to go after with these next generation of experiments. And I also, as Masha mentioned, I work on other instrumentation in the observational cosmology group to try to understand the epoch of reionization. So this is kind of like all the science that I'm interested in, plus the probes that you could expect to do that. And we're actually building an experiment in the basement right now called TIME. And that's actually trying to probe signals from early galaxies during the epoch of reionization. So if you're interested in any of my things that I mentioned today or the other science that I'm working on, feel free to talk to me after or ask questions. So yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much for that fantastic talk. Do we have questions?
Like, it'll still be atmosphere. Yeah, unfortunately, I think, like, if you're going to do something from the ground, like, you're just going to be building up the number of detectors. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I have appreciated the neutrino, that you can get a neutrino mass measurement. Could you say a little bit more about the measurement principle there? What are the, how are neutrinos interacting with the CMB?
Oh, so actually, the neutrinos aren't interacting with the CMB. It's just that if when you're building large-scale structure, before the epoch of like matter radiation equality, if you have basically hot neutrinos, they're relativistic, and like the dark matter is collapsing into potential wells, and the neutrinos are streaming out on those small scales, and so like basically before the scale of like matter radiation equality, like those neutrinos are allowed to just stream out of the dark matter, so they're basically removing mass from the potential wells, so you're overall suppressing the growth of structure, essentially. And like on the matter power spectrum, if like small scales are over here, like it looks like this, and then it like brings that down a bit. And because the measurement of the E modes being lensed into B modes is basically integrating over the structure that you do have, it actually suppresses that spectrum if you have massive neutrinos in the early universe. So it's kind of cool because it's like a indirect effect, but it lets you get at the neutrino mass that way.
I have a question. Is there a practical limit to how many bolometers you can stick on an instrument? Like, I'm thinking like transistors on a chip.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of times the practical limit can actually be like space. So it's like basically, well, there's a couple of limits, and depending on the instrument, certain ones may play in. But one of the things is that, you know, the detectors themselves have a finite size depending on what frequency you're at. So if you have low frequency detectors, they're much bigger. So if you're looking at like 30 gigahertz detectors, you can only pack so many in a focal plane, where the optics have like good properties. The telescope optics have good properties in that focal plane area. And then you also have like so that's kind of like a limit for like low frequencies. So if you have like really high frequency detectors and you can pack a lot, you actually can kind of run into problems of actually reading out that many detectors. So then it's like a readout problem. How do you get the wires out of the focal plane? And you know, how do you like read out that many detectors just from a practical limit of like the electronics that you need to read them out. So, yeah, I mean, there's folks in this building that are working on like different technologies for, using different detectors that are like easier to read out, for example, because the readout can actually become a big issue. But it kind of depends what parameter space of the instrument you're in.
Any more questions? Okay, yes.
Yeah, so I don't actually know if there's other astrophysical effects that would mimic it directly, but one of the issues that is kind of an astrophysical effect is that you have to know overall like how much, like what the matter density is in general, so you have to measure that from other probes of large-scale structure, basically like optical surveys. So you do have like another astrophysical, like you're basically using those two data sets together to make this measurement. So if you didn't, like if you just had no way to measure the density of, you know, matter in the universe, then you wouldn't be able to make this measurement because that would also affect the amplitude.
Okay, any last questions? Okay, let's thank Abby again.